Let's go to Unit 3 now, which is, we're skipping around as far as,
we're skipping some chapters, notice. We're going to, what is it, Chapter 15 now, which is really just an overview of metabolism. This is the time in the term when we're going to get away from the generalized background material we've been doing up to this point and eventually start focusing on specific biochemical pathways. Not in this chapter yet, though, but this is a good introduction to the first pathway we're going to take a closer look at, which is glycolysis. And I'm sure you've looked at glycolysis before, at least in 181. Should have looked at it in 353 as well. Anyway, that's not the point of this first slide, even though this top part is glycolysis, right? These 10 steps that are illustrated here by the blue arrows that get you from glucose, a starting point, to pyruvate at the end, that is glycolysis. And we'll study that in a different chapter. The point here is just that it's a good example of a biochemical pathway. We've talked about biochemical pathways before, but a biochemical pathway is just what the phrase sounds like it is. It's a way of getting from a starting point to an end point, along a path. But that pathway is, chemically speaking, just a serial arrangement of individual chemical reactions, right? What makes it a pathway is that the serial arrangement is such that what the first chemical reaction spits out as a product serves as a reactant in the second reaction, and so on down the line. Well, almost certainly, no matter whom you took 181 or 353 from as an instructor, you studied glycolysis in isolation. And there's good reasons for that. It's a lot easier to understand if you study it in isolation, as pretending as though it exists in isolation. But no biochemical pathway really exists in isolation. Biochemical pathways connect to each other. And so on the bottom of this, notice that there's a fork in the road here, which you should be familiar with. This is an important fork in the road as far as energy metabolism is concerned. Glycolysis really ends here at pyruvate, so the bottom part of this is not glycolysis. The bottom part consists of two other pathways beyond glycolysis, but that is actually chemically linked to glycolysis, because glycolysis leads to either one of these two pathways that will continue the process of dealing with the fuel, right? But one or the other of these pathways is taken by this pyruvate that glycolysis spits out, depending on the situation, right? Pyruvate is only partially spent fuel. Glucose, the fuel that glycolysis starts with, has a lot of valuable energy in it. That's the whole reason for using fuels, right? We get energy from our fuels by dismantling them as organic chemicals through the process of oxidation. Well, there's oxidation that's occurring in glycolysis, but the pyruvate that glycolysis spits out still has useful energy in it. And that's why, if oxygen is present, at least for an aerobe, meaning an organism that is able to aerobically respire, then that oxygen will perform what function? What is it? If there is oxygen, what does it do for an aerobe? Well, what about the relationship between oxygen and the electron transport chain?
Electron transport chain.
It's the final electron acceptor, right? That's almost the whole reason we need oxygen. So when it's available, then we can undergo this rightmost pathway at the fork, which is respiration, right? Glycolysis is not really respiration. That's a whole separate pathway that occurs first. Respiration can occur aerobically in the presence of oxygen, whereas if it's not, then that whole complicated pathway, which we'll study in a different chapter, cellular respiration, can't occur. And therefore, the other pathway has to be taken. So, this really is just a good example to show you that even though we study these biochemical pathways as little isolated units in a real cell, all these pathways are actually interconnected in a complex way that's kind of illustrated in slide 2 with all these different colored lines and nodes connecting. Well, glycolysis somewhere in here in this blue part, carbohydrate metabolism, you should recognize this circle as part of cellular respiration, right? But there's all kinds of other pathways that really have nothing to do with energy metabolism that are in there as well, all connected together. Well, how can the cell make sense of this? Well, think about what we've said in previous lectures about pathways. A pathway is a pathway because it's an end-to-end arrangement of individual reactions. But what's also true of reactions in general that occur in cells? How are those reactions allowed to proceed? Right. Just about every chemical reaction that occurs as part of metabolism is catalyzed by its own fairly specific enzyme. So this looks like a mess when you draw it in this tangled way, but it proceeds very orderly because pathways are able to be turned on or off by controlling whether enzymes work or not. And remember, there are enzymes that are non-allosteric, Michaelis-Menten enzymes, and there are allosteric enzymes, which are the ones that are more important for with respect to controlling the pathways. The allosteric enzymes, right. Allosteric enzymes are easily activated or repressed, and therefore the pathways get shut down or shut on.
Why wouldn't there only be just like one regulator at the first, like for the first reaction of the pathway? Because you know, like in the other reactions we saw last chapter, where it was like from A to B, they only regulated from A to B.
That isn't necessarily true. The higher up in the pathway you control a reaction, the more efficient it is because you don't make, in that case, unnecessary intermediates. But if you're talking about a pathway that gets joined by another pathway somewhere in its middle, then that middle place will have an allosteric enzyme as well. In other words, all these nodes, which are represented by the little circles, which are connection points between pathways, that's where you're going to find allosteric enzymes because those need to be control points. But when you have, as just part of a pathway, nothing but a line, and so that same thing happens the same way, there's nothing else interfering, then you wouldn't have allosteric enzymes probably. You would just have Michaelis-Menten enzymes. Does that make sense?
Yeah.
Okay. So this is just a schematic representation of metabolism. Metabolism really is life. Because metabolism is officially the combination of all the chemical reactions that are occurring in an entire organism, right? Whether that is just one cell, in the case of a unicellular organism, or all the cells of a multicellular organism. Everything combined, as far as reactions are concerned, is metabolism as a whole. And that really is what life is. Chemistry occurring in cells. But remember that we can break the big sum of all those chemical reactions, metabolism generally, into two subcategories, right? What are those? Right, catabolism and anabolism. And what's the difference between those? Catabolism is what aspect of metabolism? Yes, catabolism is the breakdown of bigger things into smaller things. Now, usually that is for the purpose of yielding some energy that's locked up in those larger, more complex molecules. That energy gets released in the process of catabolism. Some of that's going to be wasted as heat. There's nothing we can do about that because of the laws of thermodynamics. But in certain stages of this dismantling process, some of that energy can actually be trapped in the form of molecules that are created in the process. And there are various molecules that can carry energy from the that's yielded from the catabolism of fuels, and we'll talk about several of those in this chapter. But that's what the main use of catabolism is, to allow for useful energy to be stored temporarily in what we call activated carrier molecules, so that those activated carrier molecules then can be themselves dismantled in a way that releases that energy that they're storing, so that the other half of metabolism can be performed, anabolism. Anabolism is the building up of bigger molecules out of smaller ones, and that is an endergonic process, whereas catabolism is exergonic. So we have to build our biomolecules. Building those biomolecules is energetically expensive. It's endergonic. We wouldn't be able to do that if we didn't have a source of energy. The source of energy is the catabolic half of metabolism. We get the energy out of big things that we dismantle, store it temporarily in activated carriers, and then release it from the activated carrier so that we can build new biomolecules of our own, in our own cells. The big biomolecules that we dismantle in order to get that energy is our food, our fuel molecules. Strictly speaking, it's not really food. Food is a collection of huge molecules that get digested. Digestion breaks things down into smaller chunks as well, but it doesn't give you any biochemically usable energy. Digestion actually occurs outside of the body. The alimentary canal is really outside of our body, right? It's the tube from mouth to anus. Well, our body, which is made up of our cells, is wrapped around that tube. And so we secrete enzymes into the exterior of our body, which is the interior of this tube, so that the food molecules can be dismantled into small enough pieces, biomolecules, to be absorbed through the cells that line the gut, and now they're suddenly in our body. Then they can be oxidized, catabolically oxidized, in order to yield the energy to store in the form of ATP mostly, so that that can be put to use doing all kinds of cellular work, including anabolism, building up molecules out of big things. That's not the only thing we use energy for, though. What else do we use energy for? We're not always just building up big molecules to use our ATP or to use trapped energy. Yeah, we also use it for mechanical work, moving things around, whether it's moving things inside a cell, you know, like via motor proteins, or moving the entire organism, you know, like how muscles work, moving a flagellum, whatever the case may be. That's mechanical work. And there's also transport work that needs to be done. Whenever we move something against its concentration gradient, that doesn't come for free. You have to force things to go the opposite way that they want to diffuse, right? But sometimes that's what you have to do, and that requires energy as well. All right, well, let's go to slide 3 and look at ATP, which is not just the main energy-carrying activated carrier molecule in your body. It's the main one in all cells known. So all three domains, use ATP. This is an ancient molecule. It's been doing its job for billions of years. But what is ATP, chemically speaking? Now, you know, a functional definition is that it is an activated carrier molecule. At least, that's one of its jobs. But chemically speaking, structurally speaking, what is ATP? It is a nucleotide, exactly. And that's simply because it fulfills the requirements of being a nucleotide. It has the three components necessary to be a nucleotide. What is the black part here? Specifically, that is ribose, exactly. You know it's ribose because there's an oxygen here and here, right? If you just had an H here and not an OH, that would be deoxyribose. But ATP uses ribose as its pentose sugar. And for it to be a nucleotide, two things have to be connected to that, right? In blue, we have what? Adenine. That's the nitrogenous base, the specific nitrogenous base that's used in this particular nucleotide. And then also connected to the ribose, you have to have some number of phosphates, right? Well, strictly speaking, you wouldn't really call them phosphates when once they're connected to the rest of it. They are phosphoryl groups, but we usually go back and forth between phosphoryl, which is more correct, and phosphate, which is really describes what they are as when they're on their own. Anyway, that's why we call this thing adenosine triphosphate. What is adenosine? It is the base and the sugar, but what is it an example of? A nucleoside, exactly. And that's why another name, I mean, a word that describes the specific molecule, adenosine triphosphate, is that it is a nucleoside triphosphate. But a nucleoside triphosphate, a nucleoside monophosphate, a nucleoside diphosphate, those are all examples of nucleotides because to be a nucleotide, you just need to have a nucleoside and some number of phosphates. There are other nucleoside triphosphates. And so, for example, you know of the importance of ATP for energy metabolism, for carrying around these phosphates for the purpose of energizing other molecules. But what's another use of ATP? What is it? No, not DNA replication, because that would be... No, that would be... Why don't you use ATP in DNA replication? Why? Right. You would use it for RNA replication. I mean, RNA synthesis. It's a raw material for stringing together RNA nucleotides, right, to make an RNA molecule. Even though when you make an RNA molecule, the nucleotides that are strung together... And similarly for DNA, only with deoxyribose as the sugar, you don't have still in place in the complete nucleic acid triphosphates, right? You only have one phosphate per nucleotide in the final product of either a DNA or an RNA molecule. Why are the raw materials, therefore, nucleoside triphosphates? Right. Synthesizing an RNA or a DNA molecule is anabolic. It is endergonic. It's expensive to do. So you, even though in the final product, two of those phosphates need to not be there, just one needs to be there, you need to start with raw materials having those phosphates in place because cleaving those off will release energy that will allow this anabolic endergonic process to proceed. And so... In terms of making an RNA molecule, that really points out two major uses of ATP simultaneously. It is the raw material. It's a monomer of the polymer that's being built. But it's also bringing in, as a triphosphate, the energy that's required to polymerize this increasingly big molecule. Okay? Well, there are other... You know, this is just the one that features... Adenine is the nitrogenous base. So you have the other ones as well. Those would all be raw materials for RNA, right? Uridine triphosphate, when uracil is the nitrogenous base, and so on. But AT, and those are, even though they're raw materials for RNA molecules, they are also, because of the fact that they are triply phosphate, phosphorylated, high energy carrying molecules. But ATP, for whatever reason, evolutionarily, was the one that got picked by natural selection to be the main molecule. But you do know that it's not the only one doing the job, right? Like you said, GTP is also used often for exactly the same reason, for carrying energy as an activated carrier. ATP is by far the main one, though, and not just in you, in all cells. All right, so notice that we have ATP on the top left. If that gets dephosphorylated, if it loses one of its phosphates, namely its terminal phosphate, which notice we can call the gamma phosphate because they're alphabetized in the Greek alphabet, alpha, beta, gamma, starting from where they connect to the sugar. If we lose that terminal or gamma phosphate, a phosphoryl group, then we have adenosine diphosphate. That's still a useful energy-carrying molecule, because there is still a bond between phosphoryl groups available to be broken. What do we call these bonds between adjacent phosphoryl groups? What is it? They're not phosphodiester bonds. Similar. A phosphodiester bond is the bond that you would have between the phosphate group of one nucleoside monophosphate and the sugar of the next nucleoside monophosphate or nucleotide in a nucleic acid. That's a phosphodiester bond. So the sugar phosphate backbone that holds one strand of DNA or RNA together, that's strong because of phosphodiester bonds. This has a slightly different name, though. The bond between two adjacent phosphoryls is called a phosphoanhydride bond, because when it forms, an OH and an H come out of the situation forming water. So you're taking out water. That's what the anhydride refers to. Well, these phosphoanhydrides really represent the usefulness of this molecule as an activated carrier. In other words, ATP is spent, as we say, to do some useful thing in the cell by breaking phosphoanhydride bonds. And ATP has two possibilities. You can break the terminal phosphoanhydride bond between the beta and the gamma, and that will release some energy, forming ADP. What's left over is just now a phosphate by itself, right? What name do we give to a phosphate that's on its own? Well, it's no longer associated, once this gamma has been released, it's no longer associated with a carbon skeleton. So we call it inorganic phosphate, which is often abbreviated as P sub I. Just don't mistake P as meaning a phosphorus atom. A phosphorus atom is just part of the phosphate, right? There's oxygen there as well. So P sub I stands for inorganic phosphate, but you can also call, if it's just a single phosphate by itself, we can also call that orthophosphate. You can cleave that only remaining phosphoanhydride bond that ADP has to spend some more energy from this thing. And that will get you AMP, adenosine monophosphate. That will also yield another orthophosphate. But you could also, starting with ATP, cleave two of the phosphates off by breaking the bond between alpha and beta. And in that case, you would go straight to AMP, and you would have two phosphates still stuck together, neither of which is connected to a carbon skeleton. So that's also inorganic. But what name do we use when it's two phosphates on their own? I mean, together, but away from the carbon skeleton. We call that pyrophosphate. Okay? So Inorganic pyrophosphate is often symbolized as PP sub I. Just to show you that the two P's are connected. Let's go on to slide. Well, actually, before I go to slide four, let me give you three major reasons why this ATP molecule is well suited to being a carrier. The reason it's called an activated carrier is because it would make no sense for the cell in terms of usefulness to stick these phosphates onto AMP to make it ATP unless you could get them back off in the spending part of the transaction, right, in order to do some work for you. So ATP needs to be able to give up these phosphates in order for it to do its job of releasing energy for useful work. And there are three major reasons why it's able to give up this phosphoryl group at its end, this gamma phosphoryl group. One is that there is repulsion between electrostatic charges. So electrostatic charge repulsion is the first reason why ATP is a good candidate for being a molecule that will be able to give up its phosphoryl. And you can see the charges in ATP in the upper left. They're negative charges that are close to each other. Well, like charges repel each other, right? So this thing is able, it is fairly stable if you don't have an enzyme around to try to dismantle it, despite those charges repelling each other. But it will be even more stable if you remove a phosphoryl group to get those charges away from each other. Okay, so that's one reason. Another reason is shown in slide four, which is stabilization because of resonance. Resonance stabilization is illustrated by the four different versions of phosphate that you see here. Notice it can go back and forth between any of these four. What's really changing is the position of the double bond, right? And these are all, even though they are of different energy levels, slightly different, they're all about the same energy level. And therefore, they're all equally, or not entirely equally, but they're all able to actually happen in a real cell. So there's more freedom with respect to resonance. There's more ways for these resonance forms to occur in an isolated or inorganic phosphate than there is in a phosphoryl group that's still connected as part of ATP. In slide 5, we can see that. ATP here is listed as AMP with two phosphates on it. Still, overall, it's ATP, though, right? One of the phosphates is in the letters AMP. Well, the terminal phosphate group is what you need to focus on here. It can undergo different resonance configurations as well. But this last one, if you consider the resonance structure with the double bond here between this phosphate, the phosphorus and this oxygen, that's not going to be very well favored because it brings these positives together. Okay? So a phosphoryl group, that means there's really only these three possibilities, whereas if a phosphate is on its own, it has four possibilities. That's a greater sense of freedom with respect to entropy, right? And therefore, it's energetically favored. It's more stable that way. Goes down in G level. Remember, when you decrease G, you are increasing stability. Well, that's another reason why ATP is willing to give up its phosphoryl group in order to do work for the cell. And then another reason is that there is an increase in stability because of interaction with water. In other words, because of hydration. A phosphate by itself, an orthophosphate, is able to form interactions with more water molecules than it would be if it's still connected to ATP. So it's more completely hydrated when it's on its own, in other words, than a phosphoryl group is as part of the activated carrier. Those three reasons combine to make ATP a good candidate for being an activated carrier, and we say because it's able to give up its phosphoryl group, we say that it has a certain magnitude of phosphoryl transfer potential. Okay? Well, on slide 6, we can see other compounds besides ATP. ATP's right here. But there are other compounds that are phosphorylated and that we'll be talking about when they come up in the discussion of specific pathways later on. They also have a certain magnitude or size of their phosphoryl transfer potential. This, by the way, should be a delta, not a D. That's just a publisher mistake. But the delta G naught prime of hydrolysis here puts a number to the phosphoryl transfer potential. In other words, the higher one of these things is on the graph, the more willing it is to give up its phosphoryl to something else below it. Well, ATP is not at the top of this chart. Phosphoenolpyruvate, which we'll talk about, 1,3-bisphosphoglycerate, which we'll talk about, are both higher. So is creatine phosphate. And that's important because ATP is so versatile, mainly because it's intermediate on the list. There are things that are higher, and therefore ADP can receive a phosphate from them to become ATP, which is kind of the goal in terms of energy metabolism, because ATP is so versatile with respect to its ability to provide energy to some endergonic process. It's able to be phosphorylated by things that have an even greater phosphoryl transfer potential, but it's also higher than a bunch of things, which is why it's able to give up its phosphoryl group in order to power those reactions. So that intermediate position in terms of phosphoryl transfer potential is really important for ATP. The creatine phosphate one, by the way, is, does anyone know where you find this stuff in abundance? In muscle, right, in skeletal muscle. It's an example of something we call a phosphagen. Gen meaning creation. It doesn't really create the phosphate, but it gives it up. A phosphagen is something that stores energy in the form of these phosphoryl groups, but can give them up to ADP in order to recharge that ADP back into ATP. And that's important in skeletal muscle because you only have so much ATP in your body. It's not all that much in terms of overall mass, but it's turned over ridiculously quickly, meaning that you keep reusing that small amount of your total ATP in your body over and over. It keeps going back and forth between ATP and ADP. And that happens so quickly that in your skeletal muscles, if you're exerting yourself, you would run out of ATP within a second or so. You would have ADPs, and then those would become AMP. You'd be out of energy quickly, usable energy, because you'd be dephosphorylating your activated carriers, your ATP activated carriers. Well, in muscle, there's a much higher concentration of creatine phosphate than there is ATP that is acting as a storage of phosphoryl groups. So that when you do use the ATP, which is what you use directly, that's what you spend directly to do the muscular work, that will make ADP, that will leave ADP, right, an inorganic phosphate. But that ADP molecule can immediately receive another phosphoryl from creatine phosphate. The phosphate that creatine is carrying is transferred to ADP to turn it back into ATP to allow you to continue muscular contraction. And that happens because creatine phosphate has a higher phosphoryl transfer potential than ATP does. And so it's able to give it up to the one that's lower. Graphically, we see that in slide 7. Notice that just in seconds, the amount of ATP is depleted. Creatine phosphate takes over in that very short run to, instead of bringing, so the effect of this is that the ATP doesn't really go down as much as it would. The pink trace indicates what would happen if you didn't have the phosphagen. But because you have the creatine phosphate, much of that ADP is turned immediately back into ATP, and it keeps it high until such time later on, when you get into the minutes, when ATP can be created because of aerobic metabolism, right? Because that's the goal of respiration, is to produce ATP from the energy that's in the food. Well, first you just make ATP in the very short run by simply transferring phosphorals from the phosphagen to ADP. All right, so in 8, we see the central role that ATP plays in all cells. Notice the arrows. It's going back and forth between ATP and ADP all the time as a cycle. And in doing so, it links anabolism with catabolism. This is a really important point in biochemistry and in biology in general, is that we're able to perform endergonic reactions. We're able to make them be spontaneous and actually occur, even though they're uphill energetically, because we couple those reactions, those endergonic reactions, with reactions that are even more exergonic than the endergonic requirement. We couple our endergonic reactions with reactions that release so much energy that there's even more than we need to drive the uphill part. And ATP is almost always involved in those. It's the main energy currency. It's usually how it's described in textbooks, as the energy currency. That's a good analogy, by the way. It's a good analogy with monetary currency. Because when you think about money, it really by itself is useless, right? You can't eat it. You can't survive by eating money. But what it represents is effort, right? Nowadays, few people work directly for their food and the other things that they need. Instead, they work at some other enterprise, and in return for that effort, they store that effort, in a sense, in the form of money that they get in exchange for that effort. And then that's versatile stuff. You can spend that money any number of ways in order to do something that requires effort. Right? You spend the money in order to get the payback. That's what ATP is really doing. It's temporarily storing energy that you get from fuels, and you get that energy from the fuels by oxidizing those fuels. And then that ATP being so versatile means that you can do just about anything that requires energy in the cell. You can do all kinds of endergonic processes, including anabolism, which here is called biosynthesis, right? Biosynthesis refers to synthesizing or bringing together molecules to make bigger things. That's anabolic. But we've said moments ago that that's not the only thing that requires energy, right? Various kinds of motion, active transport, signal amplification, we didn't say, but that, and all of these things in the pink box require energy. That's going to spend ATP, turn it back into ADP, but ADP can be recharged into ATP simply by dismantling the carbon skeletons that make up the fuel molecules. That's what you do in glycolysis and cellular respiration. You take an organic compound that is rich in energy because it's highly reduced, and you undo that reduction, right? The opposite of reduction is oxidation. That's how you claim the energy from those fuels. And a lot of that's lost as heat, but a lot of it gets stored in the form of these ATP molecules that are formed in the process. Now, this photosynthesis on the bottom, really it's just a part of photosynthesis that it's talking about here. If you recall, photosynthesis is made up of two big parts, right? The light-dependent reactions and the Calvin cycle. Well, the light-dependent reactions is really what should be written here, because that's the part that allows you to make ATP, allows the plant to make ATP. Because it's the sun energy and sunlight that gets captured. That ATP actually gets spent in the second half of photosynthesis when you actually make the sugar. Well, that's biosynthesis. Making that sugar out of carbon dioxide is making a more complex thing. So that actually requires the ATP, but you need to make the ATP using sunlight first. All right, now let's go to 9. These are simple fuels. It is the simplest hydrocarbon that you can have, methane, simplest because it has just one carbon atom. Methane is natural gas, right? And it's a good fuel. The reason it's a good fuel is because it is highly reduced with respect to the carbon atom. What's happening to the carbon atom is what's important here. The carbon is becoming oxidized as you go from one fuel on the left to one on the right, to the next one on the right. Methane, being a hydrocarbon, has nothing but carbon-hydrogen bonds, right? There's only carbons and hydrogens in the molecule. Since there's only one carbon, the only bonds are carbon-hydrogen bonds. And that not only makes it a nonpolar substance, right, because of the near equality of electronegativity of carbon compared to hydrogen, right? That's what makes it nonpolar. But that's also what makes this a highly reduced compound, because the two electrons that are in each of these bonds that are being shared by the carbon and the hydrogen, because of that equality of electronegativity, are being shared equally, right? And so they're not particularly close to either one of the two atomic nuclei. Okay. When you oxidize methane into methanol, notice what's happening is that you are replacing that hydrogen with an OH. Well, that oxygen has a much higher electronegativity than carbon. And so, yes, there still is a sharing of electrons here between now the carbon and the oxygen, but those electrons spend a lot more time around the oxygen now than they did around the carbon. So from the viewpoint of the carbon, even though it's not totally losing electrons, it's partially losing those electrons. That's why it is defined as oxidation of carbon. Okay? If you represented this as two little dots instead of a dash, in the CH bond of methane, those two dots would be midway between C and H. In methanol, you would write them the two dots closer to the oxygen than the carbon. So the carbon is being partially stripped of electrons. It's being oxidized. And in terms of oxidation numbers, which is just an artificial mechanism we devised to make things easier to deal with when we try to figure out what is being oxidized. You remember how these oxidation numbers work? Hydrogen is always positive 1. Oxygen is almost always negative 2, right? So the four positive ones of the hydrogens in methane add up to positive 4. The overall molecule needs to be 0. Therefore, the oxidation number of carbon in methane is negative 4, right? In methanol, it's negative 2 because you have negative 2 of the oxygen plus 4 is positive 2. Carbon has to be negative 2 to make it 0. In the next one, if you do the calculation, carbon is 0 now. And in the next one, it's positive 2. Notice it's going up, and every time you go to the next one on the right. So it's becoming oxidized, more and more oxidized, until you finally get to carbon dioxide where you can't do anything more with that in terms of extracting any energy out of it. This is fully oxidized. The electrons are close to oxygen, on all the electrons involved are close to oxygen at this point. So there's no more useful energy in that carbon dioxide molecule, which is why that's what we spit out as a waste product when we oxidize our fuels, right? CO2 is on the right side of the summary equation for cellular respiration for that reason. Well, that was just using a hydrocarbon, natural gas, and intermediates along the way as an example of useful fuel. In cells, the fuels are usually carbohydrates or fatty acids, as you see here. Glucose, the master fuel in a sense. All cells are able to use glucose as a fuel. And that's what we study glycolysis from the viewpoint of, right, as the starting point. And fatty acids, we discuss these as important fuels. The reason that they are important fuels is because of all these bonds that, if they get dismantled, can oxidize the carbon atom involved. Well, fatty acid, when you look at this fatty acid, you should be able to tell why what I said before is true, namely that fatty acids as fuels have a much higher energy density than the other nutrient classes, including carbohydrates. Right? Why is that? It's because these carbons are more highly reduced. Because of these oxygens that are involved in carbohydrates, those don't have as much ability to be oxidized further. The CH bonds are nice, but these CO bonds aren't as valuable in terms, you know, they're more to the right of the previous slide's example. When you have carbon-hydrogen bonds, that's maximum ability to extract useful energy from oxidation. And that's why fatty acids are so energy dense. Okay, well, 11 is an example of this. And as is often the case in these slideshows, the specific example is not what's important, but it's good to use a real example just so you can see what's going on here. We'll talk about this again in a different chapter because this is really part of glycolysis, but an intermediate in glycolysis is glyceraldehyde 3-phosphate, which we see on the left. And that can be oxidized, specifically the magenta C that's at the top of this thing, the carbon number 1, the part that is involved in a carbonyl. That gets oxidized and that produces 3-phosphoglyceric acid. All right? Basically, the same thing that happened to methane is happening right here. But this actually doesn't happen in one shot like this. It's not a direct transition from glyceraldehyde 3-phosphate to 3-phosphoglyceric acid. Instead, as we see in slide 12, there is an intermediate step. So we're starting out with glyceraldehyde 3-phosphate, and what's happening is that the hydrogen of this CH bond gets picked off, and a hydrogen from a phosphate group gets picked, an inorganic phosphate gets picked off. Those hydrogen atoms, in terms of electrons and protons, get stuck onto this NAD molecule. So this is all happening with the help of an enzyme. There's really two substrates in this case, because glyceraldehyde 3-phosphate is a substrate, but so is NAD, really, because NAD is operating here as what? It is operating as an electron acceptor, but in terms of the enzyme, what is it operating as? What do we classify NAD as, other than an activated carrier? And specifically, what kind of cofactor? A coenzyme, right. Coenzymes that aren't permanently attached to an enzyme but that can bind to it and get changed and then released are actually substrates also. So you have two substrates operating here, and the effect of this is that the NAD plus, the coenzyme, receives electrons that came from the fuel and therefore becomes reduced because the reception, the gain of electrons, is reduction, right? The fuel has become oxidized. But the phosphate group replaces what was the hydrogen on the fuel. That's why we now temporarily have a three-carbon compound that is doubly phosphorylated. There was already a phosphoryl group down here. Now there's a new one in blue, and which is why it's called bisphosphoglycerate. Bis means two. All right, well then this, in turn, is in slide 13. Gets rid of that phosphate that it just received. 1,3-bisphosphoglycerate has a higher phosphoryl transfer potential than ATP does. So it transfers that phosphoryl group that it just received to an ADP molecule, transforming it into ATP. And in the process, the OH is all you have left on that position, which is why you have what we said originally it was turned into, 3-phosphoglyceric acid. All right, so that's the general theme. This is how we get useful energy out of the fuels we oxidize, because by oxidizing them, we end up activating these activated carrier molecules, ATP and coenzymes. The coenzymes will eventually dump their cargo of energy in the form of electrons off to electron transport chains, so that the end result of that, of course, is to make even more ATP. But the end result is that you make a lot of ATP molecules from the energy that you release by oxidizing the fuels. And then those ATP molecules can be spent for just about any energy-requiring work that the cell needs to do. 14. What are we looking at here? Well, what is this 5-membered ring? Ribose. What is this one? Ribose. Connected to this ribose are two things, right? A phosphoryl group. And what is this 2-ring structure here? That's adenine again. Okay? So if all you had was this bottom part, ignore everything up above my hand, what you would have here is AMP, right? Adenosine monophosphate, a nucleotide. On the top, you have a very similar thing, except it's a different nitrogenous base. It's not adenine on the top. The pink part is nicotinamide. Okay, that's another example of a nitrogenous base. It's not one of the ones that are used in RNA or DNA, but there are other nitrogenous bases besides those five. This is nicotinamide. So if you ignore the bottom part, you would have another nucleotide. All right? They're stuck together, though, by their phosphates. By the way, what we call this bond between these two phosphates? No, it would be a phosphodiester bond if you made a connection between this phosphate and this sugar. That's what holds RNA together or DNA together. This is, once again, phosphate connected to another phosphate. Phosphoanhydride bond, exactly. But the point here, in terms of the nomenclature, is that you really have two nucleotides here hooked together, right? And that's why this overall thing is an example of a dinucleotide, which is why it makes sense to call this thing nicotinamide adenine dinucleotide, NAD. And that is a very important activated carrier molecule. Whereas ATP is an activated carrier of phosphoryl groups, which are important for energy. The bonds represent energy. NAD is an important carrier of energy in the form of electrons. And so this NAD molecule, which is also functionally qualifies as a coenzyme, it operates by receiving electrons to become the reduced form, and by giving up those electrons to become reoxidized into the oxidized form. All right, so the reactive site that's labeled there, that's where the pickup of electrons occurs. But it's not just electrons. If we look at slide 15, we're looking at just the business end of NAD here. R represents the other nucleotide and the phosphate. This is just the nicotinamide portion, which is the only thing that really matters with respect to receiving the electrons. So you have NAD plus. That is the shorthand name for the oxidized version, right? If you think of these coenzyme molecules, NAD and other ones we'll discuss later, as little taxis that shuttle around electrons from one place to another, the oxidized form is the empty taxi. It's not carrying a cargo of electrons. And those electrons represent energy. Energy that eventually will be invested into making more ATP. But for the moment, the job of this NAD molecule is to accept electrons from the fuel. That means the fuel is losing electrons, right? And therefore, what's happening to the fuel chemically? It's being oxidized, just like I told you. That's how we use our fuels energetically. We oxidize them. Well, when it comes to stripping electrons from fuel completely, we place those stripped electrons temporarily onto these coenzyme molecules, one of which, the more important one of which, is NAD+. And we do that by stripping two hydrogens off of the fuel, two hydrogen atoms. But if you think of two hydrogen atoms as a collection of subatomic particles, really what that is two protons and two electrons, right? Because a hydrogen atom is just a proton and an electron. The protons are symbolized as H+. A hydrogen ion is just a proton. So two H pluses and two E minuses, which are the electrons, come from the fuel that comes from your food. When they get stuck onto NAD+, it can't actually accept all four of these particles. But notice the oxidized form is NAD+. It's already positively charged. So you have two electrons, two protons to work with. If you use one of those two electrons, that's going to just turn it into NAD, because the negative electron is going to undo the positive charge. Right? Then if you take one more electron and a proton, those two together are just a hydrogen atom, right? And that's why if you also add those on, you make NADH. But that still leaves a proton that you haven't accounted for. That proton actually isn't being carried, even though it came from the food, the fuel molecule, it's not being carried by the coenzyme. It's still on its own in solution. And that's why books will often write the reduced form of NAD as NADH and H+. Because it came from the food, it's just not being carried by that actual coenzyme at the time. And notice the double arrow, because that's the job of a taxi. A taxi picks people up, but it also drops them off so that it can pick more people up. So just like ATP goes back and forth between that form and ADP, NAD goes back and forth between NADH and H+, the reduced form, the more high energy form, and NAD+, the oxidized, less energy form. Slide 16 gives you an example of how this actually happens. It's really not a specific example. This is just a general scheme, because you just have R's here representing some alkyl groups. But NAD is typically used in dehydrogenation reactions. We call dehydrogenation reactions that because of what you think just from the name of it. To dehydrogenate means to take hydrogens off of, right? When you pick off those hydrogens, you're taking electrons away, and therefore it qualifies as oxidation. You're also taking protons at the same time, though. And that's going to turn NAD plus into NADH with a proton left over. Now that NADH molecule, the reduced form, is carrying a lot of useful energy. In fact, more energy by far than is carried in an ATP molecule. And this is a really important part of the overall payoff at the end of cellular respiration, which we'll talk about in another chapter. But you already know the end of cellular respiration, right? You have a final big payoff in terms of ATP production, because each individual NADH that's produced in the process along the way is carrying enough energy to make multiple ATP molecules. So never forget about NADH's importance when we talk about the individual reactions later on in glycolysis and cellular respiration. Well, you should already also be familiar with a different but similar coenzyme, which we're looking at here. Which one is this? This is not NAD. It is what? It's FAD, right. The black part is simply adenosine monophosphate, right? Same thing that's part of NAD. The only difference here is the blue part, instead of having nicotinamide-based nucleotide for the other half of the dinucleotide, we have a flavin mononucleotide being part of the other half of the dinucleotide. So the blue part has flavin as its nitrogenous base. Notice that the sugar is in open chain form in this one, by the way, but there's still 5-carbon sugar there. And so this thing is called FAD, which is just short for flavin adenine dinucleotide. And just like NAD, it has both oxidized and reduced forms because it operates as a coenzyme to receive electrons from fuel molecules. But the oxidized form of NAD is NAD+. The oxidized form of FAD is just FAD. It's already neutral. And therefore, notice it has two reactive sites, two places that can receive those electrons and protons. Since it's already neutral, it's able to receive both electrons and both protons that you get when you strip the fuel of two hydrogen atoms. And therefore, the reduced form is FADH2. It receives both electrons and both protons, in other words, both hydrogen atoms, with nothing left over. This is just showing you a typical fuel molecule, whatever the R's are, depends on what the fuel molecule is, but you pick both hydrogens off the pink ones in order to get that fuel out of that, that energy out of that fuel. 19. The oxidized form on the left, FAD, I already said, is already neutral. The reduced form is shown on the right. This is just the business end of this as well. R just refers to the rest of the dinucleotide, AMP specifically. But we'll talk about where these things work specifically in the overall pathways once we get to that chapter. Just know for now that it's an important, along with NAD, it's an important activated carrier of electrons. Okay, in 20, what we're looking at here is a transition from this carbonyl that we have here, the carbon-oxygen double bond, to a CH2. Anyone remember what this CH2 group is called? Methylene, yeah, exactly. And you have methylenes aplenty in what kind of molecules? Fatty acids, for instance, right. So when you build a fatty acid, this is just as an example. It's an example of biosynthesis. Often when you build a molecule, you are actually making it more reduced. So this carbon that's involved is more oxidized on the left. It's becoming more reduced when you get rid of the O and replace it with H2. In other words, it's the reverse of what we've been talking about for fuels, right? We're reducing this thing. Well, that's going to take reducing power. We need to invest this molecule with energy in the form of electrons by reducing it so that it can exist. And we do that, for instance, when we build up a fatty acid. Okay? Well, that reducing power comes from a coenzyme also. But usually the coenzyme involved is not NAD or FAD. It's another one shown in 21. What is the name of this one? It's very similar to NAD, notice. Almost identical. What's the only difference? This phosphate on the bottom, exactly. That wasn't there in NAD. So this one is called what? NADP, nicotinamide adenine dinucleotide phosphate. This phosphate is not the part that actually is involved in receiving the electrons. It's the same reactive site as you have in NAD. But this NADP molecule, which goes back and forth between oxidized and reduced form, just like NAD does, instead of being used to extract electrons from fuels, NADP is usually used for anabolic processes. It transfers electrons to things that you need to reduce for what is called reductive biosynthesis. In other words, synthesizing a molecule by reducing it further. That reducing power comes from NADPH. The phosphate, which is really the only difference between the molecules, is really kind of just a way for an enzyme to realize, if you let me anthropomorphize enzymes, the enzyme sees NAD and says, okay, you're allowed in because I am a catabolic enzyme. NADP is not allowed in because of that phosphate, won't fit in there. But anabolic enzymes will allow NADP in there, and therefore the electrons get transferred to the whatever you're reducing. So in other words, NAD is a prominent coenzyme for catabolic processes, whereas NADP is a prominent coenzyme for anabolic processes, which is why probably maybe the only time you've ever studied NADP in your previous requirement classes is in photosynthesis, right? It's used in photosynthesis because it's an anabolic process when you build those sugars. All right, well, we see... I guess we don't have a picture of NADP. Oh, no, we already showed one. Let's go to 22. Yet another activated carrier molecule shown here. Anyone know what this one is? This is in its inactivated state, so it's not actually carrying the thing that it carries when it gets activated. This is coenzyme A. And this is the full detail of its structure, but often if you're talking about just coenzyme A, in other words, the empty taxi, it's not carrying what it usually carries, that's often symbolized as just CoA-SH. The sulfhydryl group on the left end of this is the business end of this carrier molecule. That sulfhydryl group is going to be disrupted so that you can stick something on to the rest of this for coenzyme A to do its job of carrying things. And coenzyme A carries different things depending on the situation. But what do you already familiar that it carries? What does CoA get turned into as part of the metabolism of glucose? Acetyl-CoA, exactly. Acetyl is just an example of an acyl group. Acyl is a general word. Remember we talked about acyls? I was talking about fatty acyl groups. An acyl is just what is left when you dehydroxylate or take away an OH from a carboxyl group, which a fatty acid has, right? Has a carboxyl at the end. When you take the OH away, that leaves a carbonyl group and an alkyl group. Everything else, the hydrocarbon part, is an alkyl group. Well, when you have that carbonyl and an alkyl, you have an acyl. That combination is an acyl. And acyl groups are what coenzyme A carries around. Acetyl is just a specific example of an acyl. Specifically, it has two carbons. Where did those carbons come from? If we're thinking about this in terms of the catabolism of glucose. They came from pyruvate, which in turn comes from, originally, glucose, right? So these carbons, those two carbons, are what is left of the fuel at that point. Pyruvate has how many carbons in it? Three, which is why you make two pyruvates for every 1 6-carbon glucose that enters glycolysis, right? But that pyruvate represents the end of glycolysis, and if there is oxygen present, then you can go on with cellular respiration, aerobic respiration, right? The first part of that is to dismantle that already partially dismantled fuel molecule a little bit more, taking another carbon off and two oxygens in the process, which is why that first step yields some CO2, right? But what you have left at that point, which is still valuable fuel because it hasn't been completely oxidized, is the acetyl group that used to be two of the three carbons that pyruvate has. Well, that two-carbon acetyl group gets picked up by coenzyme A and then delivered to what process? What's the next step in cellular respiration? The citric acid cycle, the Krebs cycle, the tricarboxylic acid cycle, all of them mean the same thing. So this is an activated carrier because the process needs the help of coenzyme A to deliver this acetyl fuel to the citric acid cycle. But when it does so, coenzyme A is now back on its own, ready to go back and pick up more acetyl as more pyruvate gets oxidized. Okay? More about those details later, but this is just one of the uses of coenzyme A. It's not always carrying acetyl. It's also important, as we'll see later, in metabolism of fatty acids. It can be more than two carbons that it's carrying. It can be a bigger acyl group, in other words. Oh, by the way, the bottom of this just shows you why CoA qualifies as a good activated carrier, meaning why it's still able to willingly give up whatever it's carrying. And that's because the bond that is formed between the acyl and what was a sulfhydryl, SH, that is very similar to the ester bond that occurs between glycerol and a fatty acid, which is represented right here. That's an ester bond. Thio is a combining form that means sulfur. So we call the bond that occurs between the acyl group and coenzyme A a thioester bond. And that does not allow for as many stable resonance configurations as you have in an ester bond in a fat, and therefore it's less stable, and therefore more willing to give up its cargo, which is an important part of its job. So it receives an acyl group; it also gives it up in the appropriate situation. Final slide, 24. Introduces the notion of energy charge, which we'll talk more about in other chapters. But the energy charge is a way of putting a number to the current energy status in any given cell. In terms of the mathematical definition of energy charge, it simply is the concentration of ATP, which is valuable in terms of energy, right? It's a fully charged bank card, if you want to think of it that way, plus 1/2 of the concentration of ADP, because ADP has only half of the phosphoryl transfer potential as ATP, because ATP can transfer two phosphoryls, right? So these are the two energy carrying versions. That divided by the sum of the concentration of ATP, ADP, and AMP. So in other words, this fraction really means what is the fraction of the total amount of this activated carrier pool that is in a usefully energetic state? And if you notice that all of it were in ATP form, then you would have 1 plus 0 over 1 plus 0 plus 0, 1 over 1, 1. That's the maximum that energy charge can be. But you never are really there because some of your ATPs are going to be dephosphorylated, spent, and therefore it's going to be some lower value. 0 is the lower limit, 1 is the upper limit, but the higher the energy charge is, the more available energy the cell has. And that's important for control of pathways because when the energy charge is very high, that's a signal to the cell that you shouldn't bother turning on pathways that will produce more ATP. You already have enough. On the other hand, when it's too low, that's going to kick into gear the pathways that will produce more ATP to get that energy charge higher again. Okay.